Doing all
very
right.
Very good. You don't know us, Ted, but we know you somewhat, and we're very pleased to have you on.
We've been going through your work this morning, so we're excited.
Thank about you what for to talk me. About.
Yeah. Think about what to talk about, what not to talk about.
You can talk about anything, as far as I'm concerned.
All right. Greetings, propagandos. It is Tuesday, May 20th at 1 p.m., joined as always by Alec. We're very, very excited to announce our guest today. They are a writer, a political cartoonist, a political commentator, a podcaster, an op-ed writer. Boy, I think I got everything.
Get to
there.
It, Connor.
But hey, please welcome to the show today, Ted Rawl. Ted, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Connor. Appreciate it.
I was super excited. I mean, I could not believe the luck because, like, over the weekend, I was talking to Connor. Or maybe was it yesterday that I was? Everybody, the big news of Joe Biden having cancer, right, hit the wire, and everybody's talking about it. And then, you know, I'm on Twitter, and I follow a lot of like crank Twitter, both on the left and the right. And immediately, I started to see tweets that are like, it's interesting that this announcement comes literally right as the Robert Hur tape drops, and unfortunately, right,
and the 2 days before the Jake Tapper book drops.
Yes, oh my God! I mean, like, and they're all related, right? But like, this has been a thing that we've talked about on this podcast before, which is the kind of unfortunate reality that news that is critical of the Democratic Party or like this center left or center or whatever we want to call these people is in the modern age basically, and maybe you'll tell us different, Ted, like relegated to crankery, right? By by the way, is like kind of the creation of propaganda in live time, right? And you have literally just talked about this on your podcast as of yesterday. I missed the live record, so I was very pleased that this morning you guys dropped it and I was able to listen to it. And I said, holy shit, Ted's talking exactly about what I'm talking about, and even I would argue in maybe more conspiratorial language, right? Like about coups, and you know, if these people knew what they knew, what are our conclusions? What are our takeaways from this?
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, one way to evaluate whether you should believe an official narrative is if it's, you know, if you put yourself in their position, what would you do, right? So let's just stipulate for the sake of argument that everything they've told us is true, 100% accurate. So, okay, so we're supposed to believe that, Biden just found out that, he has stage 4 advanced prostate cancer, it's metastasized into his bones, just found out, despite having been president, had annual physicals at Walter Reed, full physical workup, but they didn't give him a PSA test because they didn't want to use that part of his blood. Okay. And all the times that he had
falls, that part, as opposed to a different part of his blood, I guess.
Right. Exactly. They were saving that blood for some other test. His blood's so precious, presidential blood. He's also, had falls, COVID. He's had a number of health mishaps. I would say, it would be conservative to say that guy's been in front of a doctor every 6 months or more often over the last, 4 years. And so it's like, okay, well, so if the doctors fucked up that royally, I would certainly hope that Jill would.
A guy that's literally 80 and they're not doing like standard cancer screenings for prostate cancer. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah,
and I don't believe that. Right. But let's just say that's all true. And then they find out over the weekend, oh, the test came back. Joe's got this really terrible stage 4 cancer. Okay. If you're them, if I'm them, I'm going to be like, listen, we have a whole shit storm to deal with, related to the Robert Hur tapes and the Jake Tapper book all happening this week. If we release this now, it's going to look like we're trying to wash away these headlines and, elicit sympathy for the former president. Let's just sit on it for a couple of weeks. We'll make the announcement then so it doesn't look like we're trying to manipulate the news cycle. That's what I would do if that was truthful, because otherwise, it looks really, really bad. So it's possibly true, but, the thing is, it's also like the burden of proof after you've been caught lying is on you. And this administration has, former administrations and their supporters have been caught lying about the president's mental acuity. for at least the last 5 years. And, you know, basically it's a coup d'etat. They installed, they gave a bait and switch to the American people. The voters didn't vote for a guy with cancer. The voters didn't vote for a guy who was suffering from dementia. They could have if they had been told, this is the situation and you can choose to vote for him, and they chose to vote for him. That's great. That's democracy. But that's not what happened. So now the burden of proof, you know, like, there's no burden on us to believe anything they say at this point. So let them, you know, I don't know. Is it a conspiracy to ask? I mean, it's not like a 9/11 truther. Like, well, you know, it's just asking questions about thermite. This is about, like, really, truly, okay, you're saying this happened. We know that you've been lying to us. Now, you know, show us the medical results. Release the files to the press. Show us. I mean, President Trump, in his first term, released his physical and his PSA results for every single year he was the president, from 2017 to 2021. So therefore, you know, it can be done. And look at his age. I think Trump was 70 when he became president. So, you know, when they say, well, you don't do that screening for people in their 70s, that's not true. It's not true that you don't do it for presidents in their 70s, because the last one they did.
Yeah.
So it's just not true.
I mean, the shocking thing to me, Ted, I guess it shouldn't be shocking, is that on some level it is working, right? I mean, I'm plugged into a Twitter, but most of the people I know in my life are kind of political, you know, normies, I suppose, right? People that are not very online and that are not following this. And most of what they know is Joe Biden has cancer. Right. They have not heard about, by the way, a little bit of context for listeners. We'll probably insert some of the Hurt tape here, but it's dated from February of 2024. This was a special prosecutor that they absolutely ran through the fucking gauntlet in Congress. Crushing this man and saying that, you know, all of his very kind of light suggestive findings about Joe Biden's mental acuity with regard to the storage of top secret documents was what they were originally pertaining to, were slanderous, basically, and that this is political. And this is February 2024, right? A special prosecutor comes to Congress, a special investigator, I think, comes to Congress and says, look, dude, I'm looking into this documents case, and this guy can't remember when Obama was president, right?
Or what year his son died.
Yeah, and that this is, by the way, at the time, you know, a month maybe, but like this is the last off-ramp to having possibly a primary in 2024. I mean, this is arguably one of the reasons why we have Trump now, right? The through line is fucking clear.
The through line is really clear. I just picked up the Tapper book and started reading it. And that's the thesis, right? Is that, you know, Trump would probably not be president now. You know, I mean, look, we don't know that. There's no counterfactual. We don't know, you know, how he would have done versus Kamala Harris. We just know the head-to-head matchup polls and stuff like that. But the fact is that neither the Democratic Party nor Kamala Harris really had the best shot that they could have because of the actions of Jill Biden, the cabinet, members of the cabinet, members of the media who ran interference for this. I mean, this was a con job done in plain sight. I mean, you know, those of us who are familiar, many millions of Americans have suffered through having been caretakers for people with dementia. I went through it with my mother. She had dementia. She died of Alzheimer's 5 years ago. And so, you know, she died during the Democratic primaries in 2020. And so when this all was going down with Biden, I was like, okay, so I'm not a gerontologist, but I know dementia when I see it, because I spent a lot of time in a memory care center. I'm an only child, divorced mother, so it was just me and her. So it was just me, right? Not like just parachuting in. And I was like, okay, so pattern recognition, that right there, that guy running for president, he's got dementia. And so, you know, and to be, we were just shouted down. And, you know, just think about all the people who are owed apologies here, right? Bernie Sanders, Dean Phillips, Robert Herr, you mentioned. There are many others. You know, it's really, it's the gross part is that the people responsible for all this are still in charge of the DNC. They're still, you know, op-ed writers at the New York Times and the Washington Post. They have jobs that the three of us can't get, right? they make money that we can't make. And they're wrong. Not only were they wrong, I mean, I'm giving them credit. I'm going to say that they're not idiots. I'm going to say they're liars. That's better in our line of work, to be a liar than an idiot. But like, you know, they're liars. And once you've been caught lying and you're discredited, you should be fired or never taken seriously, right? I can't. I was fired from a job, from a newspaper, for misspelling Condoleezza. Okay, so I mean, which, you know, frankly, and you know, this was pre-spell check, so. You know, I'm just saying the standards ought to be a little higher here.
It's very frustrating to see the Democratic Party in this moment right now has become the party of like medical denialism. And to bring this from a macro to a micro level, and a very relatable thing for me and my peers is Sheila Jackson Lee in the 18th district here in Texas. I mean, she wins the Democratic primary, and the local politics of it are cutthroat. Shout out Amanda Edwards. I hope you have a chance at getting her seat. But she wins in March of 2024. Dies in July from pancreatic cancer. She had to have known. Who's her seat filled by? I mean, after her daughter, who stepped up, but it's Sylvester Turner, former mayor of Houston, who had jaw cancer. And then he, you know, apparently goes into remission, wins Sheila Jackson Lee's seat, dies months after taking office. And now we have John Fetterman, who is claiming like, no, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. And then we've got Jerry Connolly being like, no, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. I should.
Diane Feinstein.
Is there anybody in politics that does not have either, you know, a debilitating brain disease or injury or, a fucking terminal cancer? Can we please get somebody that is not dying?
Well, I mean, look, any of us could just drop dead during this broadcast, right?
I mean, suppose
that can happen. But like, yeah, it's a numbers game, right? It's odds. And like, you know, we know from all the evidence of, you know, the doctors who've talked about prostate cancer, it's a slow moving cancer. And I know he's got supposedly an aggressive version of a slow moving cancer, but it's basically like, if it were an animal, it would be a fast turtle. Okay.
Yeah.
it's not exactly like, you know, like breast cancer moves a lot faster. So it's, you know, the fact is there's no way in hell that he didn't have this many years ago, and there's no way in hell he didn't know about it almost immediately. So probably I'd bet everything I own that we're going to find out that he was informed that he had prostate cancer before he was elected president.
Well, his family was informed, because I don't know if informing him does much.
Right. Yeah. And right. I agree with you, Ted. I absolutely think he knew, because we just have to look at who's the Biden that Joe won't stop talking about. Bo died of cancer.
Oh,
maybe, you know, I don't believe that it was prostate cancer. I believe he got a form of cancer from the burn pits in Iraq.
Right.
But like, he talks about Bo a lot. And as a cancer survivor and with family members that have cancer, when someone close to you gets cancer and dies of it, you get a cancer screening. You are very afraid,
that's very funny,
especially if they're family, you keep an eye on it. So yes, Ted, right. I'm going to second that bet.
And if you're old, prostate cancer is always in the cards for you. I mean, I was told by my urologist that, you know, your odds of getting prostate cancer are roughly the same percent as your age. So, you know, I mean, if you're 80 years old, you know, 4 out of 5 chances you're going to get it. I mean, and if you do get it, it's not really that big a deal, because probably you'll die of something else before it gets you. But the point is, you're old, and you know that prostate cancer is always an issue, right, for older guys. So,
I mean, Ted, it's the most base joke about being old that Americans tell each other all the time, right? Is like going to the doctor to get the finger, right? I mean, it's anyway.
Right.
So I what I want to talk about also, right, is not just the not just the cancer stuff, but about the Jake Tapper book and to a degree about the Robert Herr tape, right? The other side of the propaganda that we're kind of seeing created in real time is something maybe perennial, right? But it deserves being pointed out, which is the kind of reframing these mea culpas, right? Or like half mea culpas that you're seeing in the media, where you take something that is clearly, I knew about this and I lied, right? Which is it has to be the case. There's no way that anybody in the Biden administration is around Biden on a daily basis for any amount of time, right? And does not see him on a day like he was at the fucking debate last year, right? And doesn't know that this man has dementia. And that "I lied" statement gets reframed as "I made a mistake," right? I should have seen this coming. I dropped the ball. But by the way, a lot of other people did, right? A lot of other people who clearly also lied, to basically keep those people, you know, in a job, keep them relevant, keep them being able, you know, with some, I suppose, with some plausible deniability before the public as people that could be a part of a legitimate institution, either the party or a media organization, right? And every time this happens, every time that we get, you know, another a vote for the Iraq war, you know, Hillary Clinton, as Connor, you pointed out on like our pre-call, right? Like, you know, well, I went with the information as it was given to me. And it's like, your job is to figure out if that information is a bunch of bullshit or not. Right. That also, you know, because Joe Biden's going to go away. Right. So the problem of whether or not he has cancer is a problem of now, the past. Right. Or the very near future. But we are going to be stuck with these motherfuckers. Sorry for the cursing, Ted. I don't know if you guys don't curse much on your podcast.
Oh, I'm the resident cursor on the podcast. No, I'm like a sailor, and I come from a long line of them. It's very fucked up, right? Like every time you watch CNN or MSNBC, you're going to see people who participated in this cover up. And it's like, I don't see how as journalists, even as pundits, how you can continue to do your job effectively if you've been caught doing that. I mean, you know, I think about George Clooney, who caught so much shit for writing that op-ed.
Yeah, seriously.
But like the thing is, now you think about George Clooney, right? You would not have blamed him to say, you know what? I hate Donald Trump. I'm only an actor, right? I'm not a political person. I can do anything. I don't have any journalistic obligation. I can shut the fuck up about this. And I've donated so much money to this campaign and to Joe Biden over the years. I don't want to lose my investment. So I'm just going to zip it and forget what I saw and hope that somehow, you know, inshallah, things work out and you know, Trump is defeated, and then, you know, maybe Kamala Harris becomes president, right, somehow. So he could have done that. Instead, he's like, he realized that his duty was, well, he was interested in the party. He thought that the party would have a better chance without Joe. But also, I think he had a patriotic motivation too. The country should have a president who's up to the job, and Joe Biden's not that man. So he was like, we just can't have this. And I mean, if, let's just say, my favorite mainstream political candidate had been the nominee, Bernie Sanders, and I found out that, I mean, I wrote a book about him. I like Bernie Sanders a lot. He's not perfect. He's to my right. But the point is that I still, you know, would have been, within the system, pretty psyched to see him be elected president. If I found out he was senile, I would rat him out.
Yeah,
I would go public. I'd have to. I wouldn't want to. I'd have to. It's just like taking out the trash. There are things you just have to do, like taking the car keys away, putting your mom forcibly into an institution when you don't want to. There's things you just have to do. They're hard, but this doesn't mean that they're not the right thing to do. And these people chose not to do, they chose to do the easy thing and cover up and go along and then know that, you know, it's all like, not only are they avoiding trouble, you know, their friends in the DNC and everyone are appreciating them. Hey, dude, thanks for not saying anything about what you saw yesterday at the White House. Thanks, appreciate it. You know, I owe you one. I give you a marker. It's corruption. It's sick, and it's really wrongheaded to say, look at this kindly old man. Not that he was ever kindly, but let's look at this old grandpa who was like, never mind that he was always an asshole. And feel sorry for him, like. Like, okay, it's neither here nor there. You're allowed to feel sorry for him if you want, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, I don't want someone with bad vision piloting my plane. I feel sorry for them that they can't see well and they're never going to be able to fly the plane, but they can't fly the plane. The same reason that I can't be in the NBA. There's just like a lot of things that we can't do. Joe Biden you know, he got to be vice president. That's pretty good. He should have been satisfied with that.
I mean, the sympathy for Joe Biden thing, I mean, it's not just nauseating and in line with, like, what's going on in Gaza, but it's like, where's my public option vote, you motherfucker, before I, like, cry tears for your 82-year-old ass? I don't, dude, you got cancer? Everybody gets cancer. If they didn't fix you with fucking Walter Reed, then you're not going to get fixed, right?
And yeah. He's had it for 10 years.
Yeah. Connor, were you going to say something?
Well, I mean, unless we have anything else to say.
I have one more thing. I promise. We'll exit the rant zone.
Your obsession with Joe Biden's asshole lingers on. So keep going.
So, like, the reason that I brought up the thing about the right-wing framing is, Ted, I don't know where you live right now.
You used to
be in California. So you're in New York City. Connor lives in Texas. We grew up in Texas. I live in the deep south, right? I live in Louisiana. And I can tell you, I work with a lot of, like, Trump guys. Right. Guys that have Trump hats and all this stuff.
Sure.
And some of them are borderline. Right. But I will tell you that Americans are generally right. Like, you know, sometimes my friends from the coast have a hard time believing this. But even like the diehard, you know, crazy Trump people have a tremendous mismatch in their political vision for the United States, right? That classic thing where let's say something that sounds like, you know, something from fucking Franco, right? Like just straight up Nazi shit. And then follow it up with like something that is positively like Marxist, right? They conflate these things openly. They don't really have a focused ideology. But what I will tell you is it's way harder every time, you know, you get them on a thing where not necessarily social progressivism, but some kind of economic progressivism. They fucking hate rich people and they hate getting screwed, right? Which they know they're getting all the time. Mm-hmm. Their big thing about the Democratic Party is it's full of insiders and all these motherfuckers are constantly covering up for each other and lying about each other, right? And ceding this to the right wing framing and then defending the administration by saying, I just didn't know, right? A lie that's so obvious that a guy that is, you know, I work with people sometimes that are functionally illiterate and they know this, right? They can see it for what it is, right? That makes it a party that I'm just shackled to. There's no argument that I can make to ever bring these people. If there was a Bernie Sanders, right? Like you're saying, he's shackled to the party that lied about Joe Biden.
Yeah, true.
Right? They know when Fox News, when talk radio or whatever brings up, you know, I thought the Democrats were, you know, the party about believing in medical science. Remember from COVID, right? I thought they were. We heard for years that the job of the Democrats now was to rebuild our trust in American democracy and trust in the media and good governance, right? And it's like, yeah, but everybody that was around him lied that he had dementia for, you know, 4 years. Like, it's just untenable.
Right. That's very true. And, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it was never the Republican Party brand that they were big truth tellers, right? But the Democratic Party brand for the last 10 years, it has been that we follow the science, you know, although that even with COVID,
yeah,
that turned out to not really be true. But OK, like deny the lab theory until it turns out to be true. Right. So I do believe in following science, the scientific, system of inquiry as much as possible, you know, all the way. But, you know, most people don't do that. And this party has, I mean, they have. I agree with the perception. I mean, they are. I had a lot of Republican friends who always said, oh, you know, Democrats are a party of coastal elites. They look down on everybody and flyover country. And I didn't really know what they meant by that. But now I've come to understand it. I mean, I see it. It's true. It's like they just, you know, like when I tell my friends, oh, my producer, he's from Montana, right wing conservative, MAGA all the way. Trump's not right wing enough for him. They're like, how could you be friends with him? I'm like, because he's really smart and nice and great. You know, it's like, so, I mean, I don't care about those things and we can have some good conversations. But yeah, that's, I mean, you can't claim to be for the people and dislike the people.
Yes.
You know? Wow.
By the way, having dealt with the Louisiana Democratic Party and like consultants coming in right to work on campaigns that I've been a part of, I can tell you that their contempt for us is very apparent. Right. I mean, it's like, you know,
it's like shut up and vote for us.
Yeah. Or it's like, give us money because we know you're not going to win over here. Right. And by the way, spend all the money that you gave your candidate on polling. That's not going to help. right? That, by the way, tells him that you can't run progressivism in Louisiana. You have to move to the right, right? You have to be Republican light because you're in the South.
Yeah, I don't believe that.
Thanks a lot, buddy, right?
Yeah, I don't believe that.
Now our candidate's out $20,000 and,
you know. Says different, right?
I mean, hey, brother, well, you know, that's I'm not in charge of the Louisiana Democratic Party, so.
Okay. So, okay. In the interest of time, we do need to move on to one of the other reasons why we had Ted on here. Ted, you are no stranger to censorship for your writings and your cartoons. Going back to your, I believe, ongoing dispute with the LA Times and the LAPD. Mm-hmm. But more recently, in 2023, you wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal about ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say that this is a I kept trying to find the right word. So, like, it's not necessarily toothless, but this is a very inoffensive op-ed. It's just like, hey, yeah. ChatGPT got some facts wrong about me. Could I technically – it's a theoretical question of could I technically sue a chatbot for libel if they get something wrong? And OpenAI and ChatGPT respond by unpersoning you from the internet. You use chat. If you use Google Gemini or DeepSeek, you can find a lot of information about Ted. You can find out his comics, his website, awards he's won. If you use ChatGPT, you don't get a response at all. You get nothing.
Well, in other words, that's just changed yesterday, actually.
Oh, he's back on ChatGPT.
Yeah, I was unpersoned for, I guess it was two years, I guess, after that Wall Street Journal piece appeared. And, you know, I raised a little bit of hell over it. I'm not the only person that they've done this to. Apparently, Sam Altman or OpenAI or their lawyers, whoever, they had a policy of just, you know, we want to, you know, make sure anybody who says anything about bad about us, we just disappear them. So you would ask, like, who is Ted Rall? And it would be like, I am sorry, I cannot answer that question. And it was like, and you
can't
and
answer that, like, for you.
Please tell me about cartoonists named Ted from New York. They'd be like, oh, you know, it's like, I'm sorry, I cannot answer that question. I would say, who is the author of Revenge of the Latchkey Kids, which was the book of mine that sold the best. It's like, and it would like make up someone else's name. I'm like,
hallucinate a guy.
Yeah. So it's like literally like, what? So, yeah, no, but I mean, apparently they have changed their policy. I reappeared yesterday and a friend of mine asked it, is Ted Rall's reappearance the result of a change of policy at OpenAI? And basically it said in so many weasel political mm-hmm. words, yes. So,
in legalese.
Good for them. Good for them. They finally like got real. I mean, yeah, Jonathan Turley, the legal expert, also was unpersoned by ChatGPT. All sorts of people.
Well, Ted, you said the definite wrong word, which is lawsuit, right? Like that's
right.
But it's, I mean, I know it's cliche to talk about like cancellation, especially in 2025, but it's like it is funny that like there are people who are kind of, yeah, depersoned is more the right word. Like, can you imagine that, like being deleted from this thing that is now, I mean, it is kind of frustrating that we now live in a world where ChatGPT actually matters to the point where not being on there, you know, might be a curse. I mean, it might be a blessing too. Like in the age where people are subtweeting constantly, you know, Grok, is this true? And then just kind of going with whatever that response is.
Right.
But I don't know. Until Connor brought it up, I had never even heard of this. Like somebody being deleted from, you know, from the cyber brain, right? That is like the beating conscience of information now for like, maybe a generation, but maybe the boomers too, maybe everybody online to some degree. It's really odd.
Well, it's a real concern. I mean, if you think about Winston Smith, you know, in the Ministry of Truth, like cutting up newspapers and you know, memory holing the ones that they've changed, yeah, replacing them with new ones, cutting and pasting them. That's like nothing. Now, literally, there's no evidence whatsoever. I mean, I think it's spooky that like a online newspaper like the Washington Post will change the headline of the same article or change the text of that article throughout the day and to get more clicks. I know why they do it, but it's like, it's spooky. It seems to me like, you know, journalism is supposed to be the first draft of history. And, you know, at least in the past, if it stayed in a musty newspaper archive, there's never going to be any denying that like it happened. If some scholar of the future finds it, that's it, right? It, that there it is. But like now, you know, anything, you know, we're entering the digital dark ages where so much information is vanishing. Some of it just due to commercial reasons, like, you know, hey, you know, you released an LP and it never made it to CD, and then it never got picked up by Spotify. So now in the future, you know, the kids of the future will never hear that music, right? Or, and there's movies like that. There's all sorts of books like that. And then, you know, that's relatively innocent, but it's still brutal. And then, you know, seriously, the powers that be can just decide, oh, you know, we're going to get rid of Toni Morrison and like delete, and just, it would be like all of her books could just vanish from the internet and that would be it. Yeah. I mean, there's no one, if there's no print anymore, I mean, we're not far from that.
It's definitely a much more nefarious version of deplatforming. So at least if someone deplatformed, you can still find an article as to why they got deplatformed, or see their past archive before they got kicked off of a platform.
You can make your own judgment, right?
You can make your own judgment. And if you're deplatformed, you could just pivot to a different platform. Like,
there are other platforms.
Right.
Although it is very worrisome. I mean, I don't think you should be able to be deplatformed unless you do something really horrible, mm-hmm. like, you know, post child pornography or something.
Right.
You know, I think it should be extreme.
And well, I mean, the AI integrate, like the search engine already being basically our window into what exists, right? The internet defining for us, like, what stuff is and what news is and what truth is, the search engine being your window into that to kind of scrape that for what you're looking for. And now the integration of AI, like straight up overlaid over that window, right? It makes this like especially kind of frustrating, right? That it can happen not just to events, not just to maybe articles, but like literally to people is it's very like Philip K. Dick, right? It's just you know, they snap their fingers and all of a sudden it's impossible to find you, right?
Yeah.
You know Ted Rawls' name, but the thing won't tell you what. It maybe doesn't have anything on him anymore. I deleted all that.
All the people who all the people during COVID who said like, oh, my posts are getting deleted and getting shadow banned. I'm a political prisoner. No, this, what happened to you, Ted, and what happened to
email Ted.
It's on a new level.
It's the new digital political prisoner. You are completely removed. No one is able to see your work, your reading, your writings, unless you use an alternative source. And like ChatGPT is the big one in America. Yeah. If I have to use something like that, I will use DeepSeek specifically because of what happened to you, Ted.
I like Grok. It's pretty good. I mean, they all make up lies and you can't believe anything it says, but it's like sometimes a good place to start research. And then
I try not to use them at all, but Connor tells me they're actually useful. He's in academia. So useful.
Well, not even just academia, just in my day job of working in a radio station. Like, it has helped me automate a lot of processes. It has helped me debug some code. It has helped me write some code, something that would end up costing me tens of thousands of dollars to hire someone to do. Like, and I'm not a billionaire that could afford to spend those tens of thousands of dollars. It's like, oh, this problem has to get solved before our next financial quarter. Like, I have to get this problem solved. It does help me out, but
it's really good for SEO and stuff like that that I'm terrible at. It's like, tell me all the SEO best SEO keywords for this cartoon, and it just does.
Yeah,
a listener, as an engineer, I am horrified to hear that Connor's using a ChatGPT to write code. But you know, that's that's just my.
I went to a coding boot camp, and I'm still just like that. What I know doesn't work for this, and I don't know this language. I don't have the time to learn the language. But what I can say is, with the academic thing, is that it's, you know, and I'll share this in the show notes. But Alec, I shared with you this article from the Chronicle of Higher Education that people have become too reliant in an academic setting on these large language models.
It's ruined a generation, basically. It always comes back to the question of what the fuck is college kind of good for, right? This like essay writing structure of taking college courses. But, you know, the one that you're pointing to that we'll link to, there are lasting effects on students, on individuals, right? In terms of like, not just their critical thinking, but their ability to read and pay attention, right? There's a great example, right, of basically a student that was functionally illiterate that used ChatGPT basically to graduate from high school in a special ed program
with a 3.4 GPA.
Yeah, it's just like, again, right, like Philip K. Dick shit, right? Like,
and I
don't know if, you know, I'm working on an essay for my column about this exact topic, and I don't know the answer, right? Is it really cheating, right? I mean, like, for example, when I went to engineering school as a freshman, it was just the period when really sophisticated scientific calculators were mm-hmm. coming online. Like, you could, you know, and in high school, we weren't allowed to use them in, like, physics class or chemistry class. But it's like, you get into college, and it was like, and they were like, you can use it in an exam. I mean, you'd have that in the lab. Of course you could use it. And when I was in high school, we still used slide rules. And it was like,
yeah.
And it was like, oh, you know, that's kind of cheating, kind of. And
you're probably one of the last generations that used slide rules, because I never did, even in college. They were like hung up like, you know, like an old sword or something, right? They were like a coat of arms.
Although I forgot how to use it, but I bet it would all.
No, it's by the way, for engineers, if there's any listeners, they're very, very useful. And the way that they intuit, right, like calculus is pretty fascinating, awesome. Actually. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we're just so used to graphing calculators or MATLAB or whatever. Okay, enough engineering crap.
So the thing is, like, is AI cheating? I mean, was a typewriter cheating? I mean, you know, it's like, is word processing cheating? I would say no. But I mean, or is Photoshop cheating for me, right? Like, you know, adding the colors that way. But before that, I used to use a screen and cut it out and paste it on top of the cartoon. Is that cheating?
You know, I don't necessarily know if I could say that it is cheating. But you're definitely cheating yourself out of an education. And like an anecdotal example here is that I have, you know, I just wrapped up one of my final classes on my master's, and I would notice that some of my classmates would use ChatGPT to summarize an article or summarize a reading and just like get the overview of what it is. And yet class discussion, I mean, you go to a room of 15 people and only two or three of them are talking, and that includes the professor, you can tell really quick who actually read the paper and who's sure. using a computer to write your paper for you.
Who can cite a specific line, right, that they thought was interesting or developed an idea more, right, or like a yes. loose end, right, that could be tied into. You're never going to get that with a summary, right? That's not what SparkNotes doesn't, you know, I sound like an old man ranting again.
No, it's like watching the movie versus reading the Wikipedia plot. You're only going to be able to talk so much about the movie. You won't be able to talk about the cinematography, the editing, the sound design, only some of the plot points that are based on what other people summarize.
Exactly,
so you better right. hope that whoever wrote it was paying very close attention.
That's true. So, okay, where do you want to go from? Because I've got, we're out of the rant zone.
We'll be back.
We can talk. So Ted, I've got a couple of your comics pulled up, and mostly just stuff that I've seen kind of floating around like Twitter, right? Stuff that gets reposted. And I think one of the good things that your comics do, especially for me, is right, as a person on the left, it's been exceedingly difficult in the past. Well, I mean, my entire life, but especially like the past couple years, right? The Biden administration, to explain to liberals kind of the feeling, right, of like what it is that these leftists are complaining about, right? Mm-hmm. Like whenever you have a problem, why are you coming to me talking to me about Biden? What are you getting so incensed about, you know, Gaza or whatever? And like, by the way, one of them is the analogy, the four panel of the home invader, right, as like a re-metaphorization of the Israeli conflict starting in 1947, right? Basically with the establishment of Israel. That was one that I think caught a lot of traction and kind of got around because it is so, it so well crystallizes, right? Not necessarily the nuance, right? And all the details, but like, this is what it's about.
Right. You know, in my view, that's what a good cartoon does, is it? It makes you think about things that are complicated in a more straightforward, simple way. And it makes it clear, it lucid, because a lot of politics is about deliberately obscuring and obfuscating what's going on. So because usually, you know, the people who are in the wrong are interested in doing that, you know, like, hey, like, you know, like we talked a little bit about the Biden people. Oh, let's look forward, you know, like it's like 1945. We don't need to look back at like, you know, the camps and the Nazis. I mean, they're not coming back, and you know, we can't do anything for all the people they killed. Oh well. I mean, it's like, so it is very like, I think it's nice to be able to say, like, you know, in the home invasion cartoon, it's like basically the metaphor was like, you know, guys break into your house and they're like, you know, like, well, hey, we're being very generous. We're letting you have half. It's like, but it's my house. It's like, yeah, but yeah, what? You don't want to share?
I'll fucking kill you, right? Like, yeah. I mean, another one was the one I shared with you, Connor. The I think your blog post was your right to choose what we tell you, right? And so, and the feeling that is right, being somebody who has you know maybe these inherent criticisms of the party, you know, that ideologically, but we are stuck in a camp with those guys, right? Mm-hmm. And them saying, right, like, you know, there's really not much we can do. It's going to be Trump versus Biden, and
it
you know,
always
the,
will
the
be
ballots,
as long as they accept that.
The ballot's locked in, and don't vote for Trump. And it's like, well, fuck it, man. Then I'm out, right? And then right. I think the punchline is, right, like, and give up on democracy. And it's like, you see what I mean, right? Like, do you see how limited this window is for kind of choice? And then to say, right, like, well, I guess you're just out of America then, right? I guess you're just not a participant. And it's like,
that's right. I'm not a participant.
Yeah.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with not being a participant. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the way I look at it is, Joe Biden and now Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu can kill as many people as they want, but they're not doing it with my help. They're not doing it with my vote. I hate that they're doing it with my money. If I could get out of that, I would. But, you know.
I won't sanction it.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like you're not. And a vote is a sanction. A vote is an endorsement. You know, it's like you can say, like, well, in my heart of hearts, I was voting against this other person. Okay. But like the person who receives your vote is like, thanks. You know,
Hey, stop. Sorry. It certainly was for, you know, the people of Germany and the, you know, middle of the middle of the last century. Right. If you ask the Israelis, it certainly was a sanction by all those people 20 years ago that voted for Hamas. Right. And it's not a sanction for you.
Right. No, I mean, absolutely. That's exactly what it is. It's totally like I'm on board. Basically, I'm on board with what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's what a vote says.
While we've been going back and forth, sending comics to each other, I should say my favorite line that I saw from you, Ted, was, we believe that you're the perfect candidate to promote our message once we figure out what it is. Yes. I really like that criticism of the Democratic Party. But I wanted to ask a broader question of, you know, I've been following you since college. I actually went through my old sketchbook and found political cartoons I made after reading some of your stuff.
Oh, wow. Now I feel really old. Okay, cool.
Fanboy hour.
Well, I got to get it in there a little bit here. I loved your Bernie comic.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask, it's obviously changed so much from when I was in school, but can you speak to the state of political cartooning now?
Well, it's pretty much close to dead, right? I mean, I'm going to be 62 years old in 3 months. I'm one of the youngest working political cartoonists in the United States.
Listeners, he looks great, by the way, for 62.
That's very, very bad. 62 years old is, I mean, political cartooning has always been like the remora that lived off the shark of print journalism. And it's always been kind of a challenge, even in the best of dead times, to sort of educate print editors about why we were important and why readers liked us, and why we brought something to the table that just plain old words didn't do. But now the whole thing, you know, has gone tits up, and print journalism is done. I mean, so, and there's a lot of things that have gone wrong, but mainly the main, you know, so there's a lot of people who draw political cartoons or cartoons with a political tint, but there's very few people who are able to monetize doing that every week. And so what you're doing is you're seeing the deprofessionalization of it. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of like doing a podcast, right? It's like, if you can do a podcast, or you have the money, or you have another job, or you have, you know, you have support, you have advertising, you have enough people to make it work, you can focus on that and really like up your production game and think about it and become, you know, an even better podcaster. But when you're, you know, if you can't make any money, after a while, you know, you've got like wives, girlfriends, boyfriends, people saying, you know, time to get a real job, focus on other stuff. And so that's kind of what's happening to cartooning. There's just not enough people who can make a living doing it. It's very, very bleak. There's at this point, about as many working political cartoonists in Tehran as there are in the entire United States. And it's more, there were, when the Charlie Hebdo shootings happened, more French cartoonists died that day than worked in all the newspapers east of the Mississippi River. When I got into this, there were about 1,200 full-time editorial cartoonists. Now we're down to about 12. So it's very, very bleak. I got to think that at some point it'll be rediscovered. But, you know, I think what it seems to me like the obvious thing would be for news websites like Axios and those kind of places to start, CNN.com, to start hiring cartoonists. I mean, it's like basically they do all the stuff that newspapers used to have. You know, so why not have you have op-eds? Why not have graphic op-eds? Why not hire cartoonists? Why not buy syndicated cartoons? They do well when you put them online. I don't know why.
Yeah,
it's like that. But I think, you know, a lot of those people, they came out of the world of tech, not the world of journalism, and they never knew about cartoons in the first place because they didn't see them, because they came of age at a time when newspapers were irrelevant. So younger people, you know, they don't see them. I mean, like, many of my colleagues will say, they'll give a speech at a college and the kids will be like, I love political cartoons. Where can I see them? You know, they don't know because they don't see them regularly.
Shout out to the magazine Texas Observer for including a political cartoon in all of their issues. They do probably like one, and they put out an issue once every couple months. So they're very few and far between, but I'm glad that they're paying someone to do it.
That's cool.
Just like a flavor question. Is there a favorite crank political cartoonist that you like? Right, like,
oh, that's a good question. So there's a guy named Bronco who's like,
yes,
far, far right, and like labels everything. Like, it's crazy how many labels there are, and the art is it's extremely hyper patriotic, Trumpy, and it's awesome. I mean, it's like totally. My friends and I are obsessed with his stuff. Me, honestly, he should be in more stuff. He has a point of view. It's a relevant point of view, represents a lot of Americans. He should be in major newspapers.
Okay. I was thinking of Ben Garrison, who's kind of
for
more
example,
in the, like,
same exact kind of thing.
Very much in the same mold, perhaps.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, Bronco's great. So I know we don't have much time left, but there was just perusing like your like Wikipedia page, something really stuck out at me. Connor, do you have any? By the way, do you have any more serious?
I just want to give Ted an opportunity to talk about his book. So get your last point, and then we'll wrap up with the.
So maybe I could ask you about this some other time, or maybe have you back. Dude, I gotta know about going to Afghanistan to watch Buzkashi.
Oh yeah!
You might be the only person I've ever even heard about that even knows anything about this.
I will. Yeah. So, what do you want to know about first, book or Buzkashi?
Let's do plugs and stuff, and then we can do a wrap up, and I'll cut it at the end, maybe.
Okay. So, you want to do the book now?
Yeah. So we've been really, really appreciative to have Ted on. He's an author, of course, and he's got a new book, What's Left. Never mind the Democrats. Here's what's left of radical solutions for radical problems. It sounds like something that is right up our alley and the alley of any listeners that we have.
My copy was delayed. It's coming tomorrow, apparently.
No.
I wanted to show it off, but it's not here yet.
Well, soon. It's on the way.
Yeah.
Hopefully, let me know if you like it or if you hate it. But yeah, so, you know, basically the book is it's a brain exercise. What would happen if you took the existing U.S. federal budget and you reallocated everything to stuff that the left would want? So, like, you know, imagine it's not a revolution. It's the, you know, which I would like a revolution, but it's not a revolution. It's sort of a thought exercise to say that within the same exact system we have now, we could reorder our priorities and do a lot of stuff for the homeless, for the sick, for the poor, for the unemployed, for the underemployed, for the undereducated, and so on, right? It's sort of like we need a set of demands as the left in order to organize around. There's no organizations, right? There's no party. But you can't really have a party or an organization, kind of like that cartoon you mentioned, like, hey, you're a great candidate. Let's, you run and we'll figure out the ideas later. It's like, no, the ideas really have to come first. So the idea is here's, I'm proposing a set of ideas that I think most people on the true left should probably be able to get behind or get close to behind. But it's not really even necessarily about my specific ideas as much as setting an example that, like, we need as leftists outside of the Democratic Party to coalesce around some ideas. Not my ideas necessarily, other people's ideas are fine, but just a set of ideas, and just make that a habit. That's where we got to start. And once we can do that, then you can get people excited about forming organizations and parties, and then you can start agitating and maybe build up to something like a national strike. That's, you know, what we have is we're trying to do dehydrated activism, just add water, right? Yeah. Just, you know, like, hey, we can have a, you know, Facebook boycott of Amazon, or whatever, or Walmart, like in one day. And then like, gee, I wonder why it didn't work. Oh, I don't know, because there's no left-wing organization.
Imagining what you would do with power is so vital to organizing and getting people interested in even trying to get power, right?
That's it. That's exactly it. So that's what the book is. And so it's, you know, it's mostly words. It's got some charts and some cartoons, but, you know, it's, you know, it gives you some sense of like what it's like. Yeah. So it's like, if you're looking for a cartoon book of mine, this really ain't it. but I think it turned out pretty well. Been thinking about it for a long time, and I think the timing is right because the Democratic Party is in such disarray.
Yeah, we need ideas.
Yeah. And we're going to link to that in the show description. And if you can't pull up on your app how to get to the show description, just go to rall.com, RALL.com, and click books, and it's the top one right there.
That's it.
Okay, so before we wrap up, Alec, you have your question.
Buzkashi.
Okay, so Buzkashi, my understanding is that imagine polo. So it is a horse game between two mm-hmm. teams that is played with a goat carcass. Mm-hmm. This is the most popular, basically, sport in Afghanistan.
And all throughout Central Asia.
So popular now that the Taliban has unbanned it, right? Because it was outlawed for many years because it's, you know, not focusing on prayer, basically. Mm-hmm. And Ted went to Afghanistan to write...
Tajikistan.
Although
I've been to Afghanistan a bunch of times, but I went for this particular thing, I went to Tajikistan.
This sounds fucking awesome, Ted. Okay, just go, right?
So basically, you have to picture the standard... The rules are short, and there are not many of them. So basically... You have a roughly 100 meter by 100 meter pitch, perfect, roughly a square. There are teams that are kind of like loosely configured. There are alliances that shift. Basically, you've got any number of horsemen. It could be just a few, 10. It could be 500. it's like, and basically what they do is they take a goat, they cut out, they decapitate it. They soak it in saline water overnight, and then they throw this thing out into the field. And then so the first person who leans over, the horseman, can grab it and pull it and run through a goal, wins magnificent prizes. Maybe it could be anything. It could be a carpet. Could be an old – it depends where you are. It's if it's local Buzkashi, it could just be a coupon to a store. If it's – you know, national Buzkashi or international Buzkashi, like I saw, you could win a car, maybe an old Soviet car.
That's his rules.
But the thing is, so here's the tricky part. There are no rules governing violence.
It is a full contact sport on horses, which is extremely dangerous.
Anything. You are allowed to stab your opponents. You are allowed to kick them. The most common thing to do is to use your whip, your riding crop, to try to blind your opponent and gouge their eyes out.
Wait, are we talking about Black Friday at a Walmart?
Oh, my God.
Heck?
Badump.
Now, in Afghanistan, it is not uncommon for them to shoot each other.
Jesus Christ.
It's considered gauche. By other,
yeah, unsporting, sir.
By the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, the Kyrgyz, the Kazakhs, the Chechens, they're all like, it's best not to, Is it technically against the rules? No. Because so that's it. And basically, if you go watch Bushkashi, you'll be seeing like this, these mad scrum stampede. Horses fall over. People get trampled sometimes to death. The year I went wasn't too bad because the weather was dry. The year before it had been raining. So the horses were falling and people, 24 people died in one day.
Jesus Christ.
That's not including all the people. I did see a bunch of dudes get their eyes gouged out. I saw an eye fly out of a dude's face. They have the on the side of the scrum, there's like all the ambulances lined up in ahead of time. Like all of the ambulances are here. Like don't get sick anywhere in town on Bushkashi Day because no one's coming. They're all there and they're gonna be needed. It's the commentary is amazing over the speakers. They'll say be like, "Don't grab your dick. Grab the booze. Booze is the goat."
The goat.
You know, it's like, so it's Bushkashi, which is goat bashing. But Kashi is bashing. And it's one of these crazy Central Asian games. I even went, when I came back from there, I was so excited. I even had my agent set up a meeting with ESPN to try to see if we could license.
They could Bushkashi syndicate that.
On like ESPN, like 3 or whatever. And, you know, they were just like, "But it's so violent." I'm like, "Yeah, not like boxing or football.
Or
but
UFC. I mean, Christ, yeah. Like, right. Calm down. We do blood sport every day. Relax."
Oh, my God.
I mean, let me just tell you, the ratings would be off the charts.
Unbelievable.
I mean, who doesn't want to watch this?
Ted.
I would go right now if you said, "Oh, there's a Bushkashi match in, like, Central Park." I'd be like, "See ya. Gotta go.
I mean,
it's exciting as hell. The horses will run through the crowd, and so the people, so the people have to jump out of the way. And it's like
it's rally car racing, it's polo. I will tell you, like, Connor, I know it's very like, if you've ever watched polo, just the fact that these guys are like galloping on horses is insanely interesting, right? It's like, yeah. It's like, holy Christ.
Well,
you know?
I think, Ted, a real money pit for you right now would be, or money maker for you right now would be, make a satirical League of Their Own style series about the sport. And it's just like, you know, you have the grizzled person, like, "Oh, yeah, like dodgeball." You've got the ringer, you know, the person that's like, "Oh, I can't go back. I promised my wife I'd never play another round." And you get all the archetypes into this goat bashing sport. It sounds
you'll never be in the NFL ever again. Oh,
these
God,
people,
guys.
By the way, they ride their horses for the international championship thousands of miles across Central Asia.
Oh, sick.
These are badass dudes, and they're sometimes in, some women play too. And they wear like old Soviet tank helmets to protect their heads. But, you know, even like the fact that it's polo, right, they have to reach down at a full gallop and grab the booze and like drag this gross carcass along with like pieces flying off.
Yeah, it sounds disgusting, by the way.
It's totally disgusting.
They keep using the same one the whole game. Is it just points one? Anyway, it sounds so sick.
One, yeah, and you know, there's other games too. I mean, there's Kizil Koo in Kyrgyzstan, which the word "kiss" is Kyrgyz, Kizil, and it means kiss the girl. Koo is girl, and so this is a totally different sport, but it's televised in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, and basically a male and a young man and a young woman, typically of marriageable age, like roughly 20. Are side by side on horseback. They take off at a full gallop, and the guy's got to try to kiss the girl within roughly 100 meters before the end. Again, she can do anything she wants to prevent him from doing so.
Shoot him.
She can shoot him. She can stab him. She can kick him in the whatever. She can whip him across the face. And so, you know, there's a certain element of like, the guy only wins, like, in a way, if she lets him. And then the marriage is consummated in the yurt of love, like, right on the field, immediately after. But usually, nobody wins. And usually people, and basically it's like, it's all over in like 30 seconds, right? It's like, boom, they go off, she kicks his ass, he falls. If he's lucky, he's not killed, you know, he... You know, the ambulance comes, and then that's it for the game, and everybody goes, and they just keep doing that. But it's amazing because, like, you'll see it on local television, like yesterday at Kizil Koo, and it'll be like, you know, and there'll be some like Kazakh girl, and she'll be like, 374 undefeated.
never been.
And all the guys in the like cafes are like, she's so cute.
Oh, that rules. This sounds like a Ronnie Dangerfield joke or something. Oh, why don't you tell me about this girl I met.
Oh boy.
So how did you two meet? Oh, let me tell you.
Yeah, great. The most beautiful woman you've ever seen in a man just has like whip scars all across his face. Like, well,
got one eye. Yeah.
It's called persistence.
It. Totally worth it.
Yeah. Okay. So on that note, I think that about wraps up our questions. Ted, do you have anything else you'd want to say or plug before we wrap up today?
Just check out my website, Rawl.com, and my podcast, The TMI Show, every Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Eastern time. Just Google it, YouTube and Rumble.
All right.
Thanks so much, guys.
On that note, thank you very much, Ted. And as always, our listeners, Propagandos, I totally blanked on it. I haven't had my coffee.
Your eyes on the skies.
Outro. This is so embarrassing.
Just do it.
Excelsior, Propagandos. And as always, keep your eyes on the skies. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Ted.
I think it's a bit we made up that we've been going for 40 episodes on. It's insane, but
yeah, we'll change it one day.
Congratulations.
Thank you.